Welcome to those of you who haven't been before. We do lectures, public lectures, every Friday night. And this is my first lecture at Southborough, so that's exciting. I'm actually a worker on loan from Canadian Libri, so I'll only be here till the end of the month. But I've been very grateful for a year here in Southborough with many of you. We only have two lectures left this term, and the lecture next week will be by Kendall Vanderslice. It's called A Sacred Story of Meals, so please come to that if you can. And then Mary Frances will be giving our final lecture. Tonight, I'm going to be talking on technology, I've titled it Talking to Ourselves, Solitude and Community in a High-Tech World. Apparently, I changed my lecture title. Yes, Marty. Yes. Okay. Before I get started, I'm just going to open in a word of prayer. So let me pray. Lord God, thank you for giving us the chance to think about this important topic of technology and how to use the human creativity that you've given us for your glory. I pray that you would open our eyes to see, our ears to hear, and our minds to understand your truth. I pray that you would give me good words by your Spirit and be with us in our discussion time as well. In Jesus' name, amen. So I've taken a lot of flights in the past year, and I've had a chance to see how different airports work. On my way home to Canada in April, I struck up a conversation with a man in the Vancouver airport as we waited for our next flight. We entered a deep discussion about Christianity, atheism, and how we find meaning in life. It ended by him paying for my taxi ride, so I didn't have to walk home in the rain. Sweet. But such conversations with strangers are becoming ever more rare, weird even. In the past year, I've had long waits in both the Newark and LaGuardia airports. The atmosphere feels surreal. The familiar landscape of airports having radically changed. Instead of the usual small restaurant tables or booths where people might chat with each other, most of the restaurants are now structured with parallel rows of bar seating. At every seat is an iPad in its upright holder. This is the ordering system for food, but it also allows you to use the internet. These bars can also be found scattered at different gates as a service to patrons. As I observed this scene, I saw many people using two or more devices at the same time. Their restaurant iPad, their cell phone, and a laptop. At the same time, music dropped from overhead and TV screens flashed with news and sports. It seemed someone had issued an order. Whatever you do, don't let these adults get bored. Don't let them become aware of their thoughts or feelings or of the people around them. And no one seemed bored. But no one was talking to strangers. I guess their mothers taught them well. They hardly even seemed to speak to those they were traveling with, except to occasionally share something on their phones. And no one was staring out at the planes taking off and landing. No one seemed to just be thinking. I took some time to sketch the faces I could see around me. It was easy to get away with this because nobody was looking up. So you can see that's the lady with the iPad and her phone going at the restaurant. So I felt frustrated and even angry about the scene. I was journaling about the isolation I saw, but there was no one to talk to about it. It would have been weird if I tried to talk to someone who was staring at a screen. I'd be one of those people. So what could I do but post my reflections on my blog? I became implicated in turning to technology to solve the problem the misuse of technology had created. It's hard to find much public criticism of the new airport designs. One article worries that the iPad system might devalue restaurant workers. But most people seem happy with the frictionless ease of the new ordering systems and how the iPads can alleviate the boredom of long layovers. One woman commented that now she doesn't have to dig around in her bag for her own iPad. So much more convenient. We seem to assume these tech changes are benign, neutral offerings for our own comfort. We forget they emerge from a worldview with assumptions about how humans should spend their time and their money. What are these assumptions? Convenience is the golden rule. People should be looking at screens and not at each other. And they certainly shouldn't be looking inside their own hearts. Social scientist Sherry Turkle teaches at MIT nearby and has studied the effects of robotics and computers on humans and on their relationships. In her latest book, Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in a Digital Age, Turkle responds to what she identifies as a crisis in empathy. Children especially are having trouble relating to others and understanding how their behavior affects those around them. She sees this as a problem caused by the misuse of technology and argues for two low-tech solutions, solitude and conversation. She uses the phrase alone together to describe how we interact when in the constant presence of communication technologies, distracted when together and distracted when alone. We're never truly alone and never truly together. The Christian classic Life Together by Dietrich Bonhoeffer, written in the 30s, long before the distractions of smartphones, notes the same interdependence between solitude and community. The person who comes into a fellowship because he is running away from himself is misusing it for the sake of diversion, no matter how spiritual this diversion may appear. He is really not seeking community at all, but only distraction, which will allow him to forget his loneliness for a brief time. The very alienation that creates the deadly isolation of man. Let him who cannot be alone beware of community. Let him who is not in community beware of being alone. Each by itself has profound perils and pitfalls. So solitude allows us to enter community, and community allows us to practice solitude. In this talk, I'm going to examine how our idolatry of technology destroys both the practice of solitude and real connections with each other, and why both matter deeply to what it means to be human. Then I'll offer some thoughts on how we can move forward both together and alone, with hope and goodness in a high-tech world. Before I dive in, I want us to remember that technology isn't, as one person jokingly says, what was invented after you were born. I like Ursula K. James's simple definition. Technology is ways of doing things. From Fire to Firefox, technology is something we've always had, and always will have. I'll mostly be talking about communication and information technologies, but the larger principles can be applied to technology in general as we think about how it affects our human purpose. First, let's talk about embracing solitude. As humans, we desire to be seen, heard, and affirmed, to be known and loved through our ups and downs. And these are not immature or sinful desires. They reveal that we're made for connection. It isn't weakness or some unevolved part of us that longs for companionship. The pang of loneliness communicates our needs, just like the pang of our empty stomach tells us of our hunger. We can think of our quick texts and Instagram posts as a reactive response to a need for communication, for connection and affirmation, much like we reach for a cookie when we feel hungry. I know you all reached for cookies tonight, not blaming you. Our compulsive behavior doesn't mean our hunger isn't real. It just means we haven't learned what we're really hungry for, what will really nourish us. We can't ignore our loneliness or feed it junk food, even if that's what it seems to want. Sherry Turkle says psychologists understand the narcissistic self as one that needs to use people as self-objects to bolster a fragile ego. The narcissist can't approach people as they truly are, as full humans with their own hopes and fears, because they may not give him what he wants. He takes only the parts that are usable for his own purposes of ego building and ignores the rest. People become Lego kits from which to borrow whatever we want, whenever we feel our own walls of identity crumbling. When they won't share the pieces we need, we become clingy or resentful. We don't think about what the other is feeling. Relationships that involve sacrifice and long-suffering are anathemas to the narcissistic self. This kind of behavior is what we hope our two-year-olds will grow out of. We grab at pieces of each other, but we can't admit to our own loneliness. Not only is loneliness considered a sign of social failure, but it also seems like something that can't be filled. And in one sense, that's right. We can't use each other, even the shiniest Lego blocks of each other, to fill the experience of disconnection. A 2012 survey of 4,000 people living in Vancouver found that the biggest issue they reported was that they felt lonely, isolated, and unconnected to their communities. People are increasingly lonely as the world designed to give them what they want contributes to more and more isolation. Everybody wants to sell us something, and through social media, we're encouraged to market ourselves. But few people remain who want to know us without strings attached. Not only that, but we find it hard to know ourselves because we're swamped with messages about who we are, from advertisements, institutions, and self-help books. This obsession with applying technique to all our problems leaves little room for contemplation. Even God can become another technology for us to manipulate. If he doesn't do what we want, we see little point in him. So we end up with this inverted pyramid. Technique or technology controls us, and we try to control God. We hope to become gods by these attempts at control, but we end up enslaved to technology instead, begging it to fill us. With social media, we have the promise of always being heard and hopefully affirmed. I share, therefore I am, says Turkle. But we're not sure we have a true self beneath all the Instagram pictures and status updates. That makes it hard to be alone with our thoughts. If we don't practice being alone, solitude can feel frightening. We're afraid of what we'll find when the busyness stops. It's instinctual to respond to such loneliness with ever more feverish attempts at connecting. But solitude is actually our starting place for real connection. It's hard to sit in silence and be faced with who we are and who we feel we aren't. But we need to know our own hearts and God's heart in order to grow. There are many voices telling us what to do and who to be, but only in listening to God's voice can we know the truth. While God often communicates through people, we also need time in his presence when other voices aren't speaking. Time where, as the psalmist writes, we can still and quiet ourselves like a weaned child with its mother. Solitude is not just the absence of other people. Solitude also means our phones aren't there to keep interrupting us. I don't want to die distracted, a student told me recently. We can easily spend our whole lives distracted, never taking time to reflect on meaning or purpose. Our distraction has led us to lose the forest for the trees. If trees hem us in, we see nothing. When we have space, we're able to see truth more clearly. In solitude, our minds can wander in new and creative directions, sparking questions and kindling dreams. Sometimes our thoughts wander where we don't want to go, towards sadness, anger, unwanted desires. But when we take time to notice and try to unravel these things, we begin to know ourselves. We don't have to immediately reach towards someone to bolster our self-esteem. We can begin to look at our faults without being undone by them. We can take time to think of things from another person's perspective, to recognize our guilt, and to repent and resolve to try again. We can invite God to do the slow work of instilling in us not just more information, but more wisdom and virtue. In solitude, we can regain a sense of identity that isn't dependent on what others think of us. We can learn to like our quirks, unusual thoughts, and favorite pastimes without having to make them look cool to anyone else. Maybe you get a kick out of reading nerdy theology books, or kids' literature, or poetry. Maybe you like bookbinding or carving wooden ducks. Pursuing those interests helps you establish who you are. When we're alone and don't want to be, we feel lonely. But when we choose to set aside time for creative solitude, we open the possibility of renewal. The poet Rilke writes, "Love consists in this, that two solitudes protect and border and greet each other." We shouldn't be constantly available by text to whoever wants us. We should be able to celebrate each other's solitude rather than rushing to fill it and be absorbed into each other. The practice of intentional solitude allows us to respect our own and others' boundaries. Turkle writes, the capacity for solitude makes relationships with others more authentic. Because you know who you are, you can see others for who they are, not for who you need them to be. So solitude enables richer conversation. In solitude, there will inevitably be times we feel lonely. But even those experiences can become fertile soil. The Sufi poet Hafiz wrote a short poem I've carried with me for many years as I thought through solitude and loneliness. Don't surrender your loneliness so quickly. Let it cut you more deep. Let it ferment and season you as few human and even divine ingredients can. Something missing in my heart tonight has made my eyes so soft, my voice so tender, my need for God absolutely clear. As we sit with our loneliness and learn from it, we can understand what its shape really is. We learn it's not something a quick fix can fill. We have space in which to hear from God and space to welcome others into. We can respond with empathy rather than desperately trying to fill our loneliness. Loneliness can help us extend hospitality as we recognize and respect the lonely places in each other and how God is at work in the painfulness of that. So solitude enables a stable identity that doesn't grasp for affirmation. It gives us space to wonder and think creatively. It allows us to meet with God, and it provides room for the true welcome of someone else. Now that we've examined the importance of solitude, let's look at why relationships matter. So why do real relationships matter? To some of us, the answer may seem obvious, but to many it's not. To many, the question itself is a blurry one. What is a relationship? For that matter, what is real? Community is a popular word these days, but it often has little substance. Online communities are usually transient and involve carefully curated identities. If you're bored of or annoyed with someone, you log out for a while. Or better yet, you find someone new. With such an easy solution, we can start to lose track of what it means to truly relate to someone else and why it matters. I started thinking seriously about the impact of virtual relationships when a friend of mine purchased an Oculus Rift, a hyper-realistic virtual reality helmet. Have any of you heard of this? See some laughs. nodding. My friend told me how incredible using it is, how much it resembles reality. With excitement, he detailed a future in which we might have only virtual friendships and allow criminals to release their destructive impulses in virtual worlds. But even he wondered what this might mean for romantic relationships if virtual sex becomes hyper-realistic. This conversation troubled me deeply, but I didn't exactly know how to respond to the questions it raised. Is the real world better than a virtual one? Are friendships face-to-face better than internet friendships? Here's a quote from the Oculus Rift website. Oculus wants to make it possible to experience anything, anywhere, through the power of virtual reality. It also promises the magic of presence changes everything, giving you the feeling as though you're actually there. Is the feeling of being there the same thing as actually being there? Can the illusion of a relationship replace the reality? If the point of human relationships is to get what we want as quickly as possible, life in virtual reality seems like the perfect solution. You can create your dream identity and the world you want to live in. You can choose what to hide and what to reveal. You can make choices without moral responsibility. If anything gets messy, you just log out. It's friction-free. If, however, the human heart is made for something beyond perfect ease and control, we're missing out. What might we be missing out on? What does it really mean to have a relationship with someone else? In the digital era, we tend to understand relationships as self-fulfillment through the increasingly rapid exchange of information. The faster we share texts and photos, the more we feel assured of another's attention. At least, at first. Why do technologies that promise more connection and intimacy seem to be lessening the depth of our relationships? The problem lies in the assumptions driving the creators of these technologies, that the easier exchange of information is the path to deeper connection and human flourishing. But does more information equal more wisdom? Does knowing more about a person allow us to really know them? The high-tech emphasis is on immediacy and instant gratification. Grab for the cookie. We want it our way, and we want it now. The internet doesn't encourage long-range thinking or self-control. If we have a thought or a feeling, we send a text or post it on Facebook. Remember, I share, therefore I am. We don't reflect alone, then choose a good friend to talk it over with. When we first start talking to someone online, we often relate in a hothouse of oversharing, rushing to reveal our darkest secrets. Just like that. This feels like intimacy to us, but true intimacy happens over time. True knowledge takes time, and time is a value we're losing. Technology speeds everything up, and time feels like it doesn't exist. We think this is a new freedom, to live outside of time. But trust is earned over time. It comes out of two secure selves meeting without trying to control each other for their own satisfaction. They do disclose, but they also laugh together, work together, and have time to observe each other's character. In community, we can see how someone treats not only us, but also those around us. This is much richer than simply knowing the details of someone's life. True relationship requires hard work and self-sacrifice. These are not the goals that most communication technology is oriented toward. Information tech makes it easier to share and also easier to hide. It's easier to pick and choose the parts of ourselves we want to reveal and the parts of others we want to accept. This is back to using people as Lego kits. When we try to connect with others, we often want both to be affirmed and to control the interaction. Turkel calls this the Goldilocks syndrome. Not too much connection, not too little, just enough. We've come to believe that impersonal corporations like Facebook or Tinder are benevolent institutions just wanting to make us happy and give us a better relationships. So we buy what they have to offer us and allow them to market us too, even though they don't know us or care about our lives. The truth is, people are lonely and disconnected. They reveal more about themselves, but feel less known. It becomes harder to be really present with each other, because we worry about saying or doing the wrong thing, or having the same done to us. In my own large family, I've noticed a recent shift with all of my younger siblings now owning smartphones. At our last Christmas dinner together, people were texting under the table. I won't say who. It's impossible for this to not communicate some level of indifference to those around you. It's hard to begin a meaningful conversation when there are phones to compete with. Our phones provide an escape, an easy out. I'm certainly guilty too. In college, when I'd go to poetry readings where I didn't know anyone, I'd sometimes text myself just to pretend I was getting texts, so I didn't have to make small talk. Who could this text be from? Liz Snell? Sorry, I have to get this. We can fill all the awkward moments by looking at our phones. But often, it's in these moments surprising observations and conversations can happen. Our phones act as buffers in unpleasant situations, but they can also buffer us from the possibilities difficult moments may offer us. This happens not only in personal relationships, but also in the public arena. We see the polarization in politics that's occurred in part because people can easily surround themselves through the internet with people who think exactly as they do. They can pick and choose what they want to hear. But true conversation requires difference of opinion and willingness to hear someone who disagrees. It requires what Turkel calls the boring bits and the risk of embarrassment. We substitute self-protection and convenience for true relationship. We don't want to make commitments to each other because it might require pain. But when we orient ourselves toward controlling those around us to make us happy, we keep finding ourselves fractured and empty, unable to truly relate to each other. When we need someone to persevere with us through something difficult, we'll find they move on to someone who can keep giving them what they want without the requirements of sacrifice. We don't trust each other because we know we can easily be abandoned. And as George Eliot writes, what loneliness is more lonely than distrust? So true knowing of another is not just information exchange. Intimacy takes time. Real relationship takes time. It involves respectful boundaries. It seeks engagement with a larger community that can provide challenge and support. And it requires the sacrifice of self-interest and convenience for the care of others. So how can we move forward? How can we live in the reality of a high-tech world without being fearful? Because many people are very fearful about the way the world is. How can we engage with new technologies without losing the richness of solitude and relationship? I don't want to make the claim that technology is a bad thing, so I'm sorry if I'm disappointing you all tonight. It's powerful, but it isn't evil. Remember, ways of doing things have always existed. Even the Bible talks about technology. Isaiah 44 describes a craftsman who cuts down a tree and uses half the wood to make a fire and the other half to make an idol. Isaiah writes, "He feeds on ashes. A deluded heart misleads him. He cannot save himself or say, 'Is not this thing in my right hand a lie?'" The craftsman uses tools, a measuring stick, marker, chisel, compass, and axe. All of those things are mentioned in this passage. These tools are, guess what, technology. But it isn't the tools that make his actions wrong. He can choose to use the tools for good purposes, like keeping himself warm and cooking food, or he can choose to use them for idolatry. Likewise, our creativity is a gift from the ultimate creator. To reject human innovation is to reject one of God's good gifts. We shouldn't react as if every new technology is wrong, but should carefully consider whether it allows us to fulfill the human purpose God has designed us for. Sherry Turkle, who isn't, as far as I know, a Christian, claims our obsession with technology cuts against our human purpose. I agree, but what's the basis for her claims? Why should it matter to raise our children to be empathetic? Why should creative thinking or kindness be particularly human values? What are humans for? Whatever we believe about this will form which technologies we create and how we use them. Last April's issue of National Geographic quotes inventor Ray Kurzweil, "We will transcend all of the limitations of our biology. That is what it means to be human, to extend who we are." Kevin Kelly, one of the founders of the tech magazine Wired, writes, "Our mission as humans is not only to discover our fullest selves in the technium and to find full contentment, but to expand the possibilities for others." He claims it's in this increasingly autonomous high-tech sphere, or the technium, he calls it, that we can find our fulfillment. Though it has no real basis for its claims, this kind of language sounds quite religious. It takes us back to that triangle, technology at the top as our purpose and our God. But can technology live up to the claims we make of its divinity? If our existence is about pushing technology's limits, we should see an increase in human flourishing. But instead, we find higher levels of anxiety, depression, and other disorders in the most affluent societies. The solutions promised by tech-driven worlds don't seem to be working. Yet we're told, there's an app for that. There are apps to track your moods and every imaginable app to entertain you in your boredom or give you feelings of connection. There's even an app to teach teenagers empathy skills. We're trying to fix the problem with the problem. Curtis White says, "For technocrats, hope usually takes this form. Technology may be the source of the problem, but it will also be the source of the solution. Hope of that kind merely doubles down on technocratic madness, doing the same things and expecting different results." Instead of being fulfilled by technology's promises, we find ourselves less sure of who we are and who we want to be. It's easy to throw up our hands in despair and be swept along by the techno-tsunami. But we do have agency in how we engage. Kevin Kelly, in his book, What Technology Wants, includes a chapter on the Amish relationship to technology. He quotes an Amish man as saying that smartphones give you messages rather than conversations. The Amish priority is to strengthen communities. They're cautious toward what may detract from relationship. They give a new piece of technology a trial run, then assess whether it's harming the community before they adopt it. They practice long-range thinking and careful consideration before moving a line. Kelly notes four ways the Amish engage with technology. It's a good chapter title. So first, they are selective. They know how to say no and are not afraid to refuse new things. They ignore more than they adopt. Two, they evaluate new things by experience instead of by theory. They let the early adopters get their jollies by pioneering new stuff under watchful eyes. Three, they have criteria by which to make choices. Technologies must enhance family and community and distance themselves from the outside world. Four, the choices are not individual, but communal. The community shapes and enforces technological direction. Kelly admires much about this cautious approach to new inventions. He recognizes that the simplicity of the Amish life makes them much more content. However, he believes that we must embrace what technology wants, his book title, to realize how we can evolve. The Amish, and Wendell Berry, Kelly says, presuppose a fixed human nature in which our enduring souls crave timeless goods. This is not what Kelly believes. He believes we're in constant flux and can only be satisfied by what is evolving along with us. We always need something new. He says we expand technology to find out who we are and who we can be. Kelly says humans are both master and slave to the technium, and our fate is to remain in this uncomfortable dual role. Therefore, we will always be conflicted about technology and find making our choices difficult. From a naturalistic viewpoint, Kelly is right. We are ultimately slaves to evolution, both in our biology and in our inventions. We can make choices about what we invent, but our choices have no real meaning. In Kelly's worldview, we are the ultimate authority, and our individualistic society will never agree on which technologies we should pursue or relinquish. So, with no reference point beyond the human mind, we must keep expanding technology in the hope that evolution is always blindly directing us for the good of the human race. But is this the only choice we have, to wrestle with our inventions as master or slave? Can technology actually contribute to human flourishing without us all becoming Amish? Can we find a way to live at peace with what we create? To do so, we have to believe something different about the human purpose than Kurzweil or Kelly do. The Westminster Shorter Catechism says the chief end of man is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. It is not to discover our fullest selves in the technium. Surprise. Technology is not our God. It didn't create us, and it can't possibly love us. It is a tool, and if we worship it instead of worshiping our Creator, we become its tools. And how do we glorify God? By reflecting his character. Becoming more like him makes us more ourselves, more human, because we're created in his image. To understand how to reflect God's character, we should look to God in human form, Jesus Christ. He embodied what it is to be fully human. In his life, we see obedience to God that takes the form of both solitude and community. In solitude, Jesus speaks with his Father and rests from the demands of the crowds. In friendship, he shares his purpose and heart with those he's chosen as apostles. In public, he shows compassion to the stranger and the outcast, seeking those whom others have forgotten. He knows who he is and where he's going. He doesn't need anyone's affirmation. So he's able to act compassionately without forcing anyone to believe in him. Remember the rich young man. Jesus loves him, but he lets him leave. Jesus can be alone without anxiety. He knows that even if his friends try to dissuade him, he's called to lay down his life. Jesus says, "He has come that we may have life to the full." This means a life like his, rich in the joy of communion with God and others, but also a life of sacrifice. Quentin Schultz writes, "The gospel of Jesus Christ holds that he made us his friends by dying on the cross for us. Now we are to befriend others by putting our lives on the line for them. This kind of invitation to deep friendship undermines selfish logic and challenges us to cultivate non-instrumental intimacies grounded in love rather than technique." Jesus' purpose is to glorify God in right relationship with him and his creation, and ours is too. This means that in approaching technology, our first consideration should be God's purposes for us. This should be the guide for how we interact with the world around us, and thus for how we create our technologies. Humans aren't machines, and our deepest problems can't be fixed with better technology. Though technology isn't evil in itself, some technologies are more conducive to human flourishing than others. Sherry Trickle says we need to design for our vulnerabilities, recognizing we can't hide from new technologies, but instead should be mindful of how susceptible we are to misusing them. We can make choices about what values we work toward. When we reorder our relationship with technology, it becomes something that serves the human purpose, which is to serve God. The reordered triangle looks like this. So how can we put this rightly ordered triangle into practice? This is something we often consider at Labrie, although no one knew about the triangle before today. Where technology is a daily part of our lives. Though we have ongoing conversations about how to best serve the students, we found some rhythms that work well to fit human needs for being alone, alone, and together, together. We don't do these things just to be mean to you, so you know. Students spend half the day in solitary study. Although there may be other people around, students don't talk to each other, supposedly. Half the day is spent in working together. There's room for friendship built through shared life, weeding, hanging laundry, or chopping vegetables. We love discussion at Labrie because it allows us to learn from each other, people we didn't choose to be part of our community. Especially at lunch, we make time, a long time, to hear each other's thoughts and questions. At a Labrie lunch discussion, we don't promise to come up with answers to the questions that get asked. We promise a conversation. Often it's the beginning of other conversations that echo on through washing dishes together or going for walks. We don't allow phones at the table, so no one can Google the right answer. We try to listen to each other. Not just each other's words, but the tone of the words, the body language, and the person behind the words. Sometimes this is frustrating. Sometimes the topic feels boring to us. But we're often surprised by what others, or even we, say out loud. I know I am. Often we're not exactly surprised by joy when we hear someone's comments. But sometimes we're surprised by an unexpected truth. It takes slogging through some boring bits to get there. It's inefficient, uncontrolled, and at times, quite wonderful. At Labrie, we hope not to value each other only for what information or affirmation we can provide. We try to receive each other as gifts, in all our strengths and weaknesses. We try to delight in and learn from each other, rather than control or fix each other to our own standard of perfection. When we work together and engage in conversation, we learn to view each other as more than labels or issues. Community breaks down one-dimensional ways of seeing each other. We can't use people for only the parts we want. We learn to encounter a real person, a true other. Recently, a teary-eyed student told me how wonderful it was to sit at a table with others and feel delighted in, something she never experienced in her childhood. Such simple in-person practices can transform lives in ways virtual reality can never do. But Libri is by nature a transient community. For most people, it's only their community for a season. So how can we connect deeply with each other in our everyday lives? We can see signs in the culture around us that people are longing for a slower pace of life and deeper connections. Adult coloring books and mindfulness techniques hint at a desire for creative solitude and contemplation. Trends toward artisan crafts and local food seem to show a longing for connectedness and reality, not just online. In my Canadian hometown, suburban lawns have sprouted book-sharing boxes. Once a summer, the city declares a car-free day downtown, and the streets fill with musicians, food trucks, and craft stalls. New farm-to-table restaurants serve only food from local farms. These aren't full solutions to the problem of disconnect, but they show that people want to find ways to slow down and connect in person. I want to look again at the way the Amish worked with technology to see what we might borrow from them as we try to remain engaged with the culture around us. So first, be selective. Your ability to make or buy a new technology doesn't necessarily mean you should, even if the cool kids are doing it. Two, don't be afraid to try something new, but be thoughtful about it. When testing a new technology individually or in a community, consider what effect it is having. With every new technology, something is gained and something is lost. Note what is gained and what is lost. Three, think about what makes a technology worth keeping. What kind of sacrifice is worth the benefit the technology brings? Four, in communal settings such as a family, a church, or even a friendship, dialogue about the ways technologies are being used. Decide together on what's helpful or harmful. Invite others to hold you accountable for your use of technology. Even Kevin Kelly says the choices we make can shape the default bent of our technologies. What kind of people do we want to become? We don't have to run from new technologies, but we can learn to be more thoughtful with what we create and how we interact with it. We can use what we encounter on our phones as something to spark conversation with others, rather than something to distract us from real relationships. We can learn to pursue a deeper understanding rather than just more information. We can seek solitude to read, reflect, create, or go for a walk in the woods without our phones. We can be open to talking to strangers in the airport, even if that makes us look weird. We can take time to hear people who are different from us. And we can respond out of a secure identity we've grown in solitude. This takes risk. It might bore, anger, or embarrass us at times. But it's the road to true conversation, and thus true community. In our personal relationships, we can make the choice to be truly present to the other. We can sit down for family meals to ask questions of our parents or children. Valuable time that doesn't last forever. We can bring our unedited, messy, wonderful, surprising selves to the table. We can turn off our phones. Yes, that is actually possible. Look each other in the eyes and listen. We can speak with our bodies that our friends and family matter to us. That for this hour, they're only with us, and we want only to be with them. They're not with us and all of our Facebook friends or Instagram followers. They're not one more person we're hoping will make us feel good about our lives. They're free to surprise and even disappoint us, because our identity isn't dependent on their affirmation. We can trust each other, because our love is a gift that doesn't require the perfect text in response. We can love each other freely, knowing God has freely loved us first. So I'm going to end here. I'm throwing a lot of things at you, but now is our time to have a conversation. So this is an open space for discussion to agree and disagree, and I would love to hear all of your thoughts. Here, Francis.
struck recently by the narrative in Genesis, in the first chapters of Genesis, of the fall, and the idea of Adam and Eve wanting to eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and this idea of essentially this is a desire to be God, mm-hmm. right? To be omniscient, to be omnipotent. And I have felt in my own life, in the way that I look around, of technology being sort of an illusion of that, mm-hmm. Of the desire, I mean, the first sin, if you will, or even if you don't want to call it the first sin, the first misled mm-hmm. desire, and how technology, especially as we have it today, I mean, I guess even if you think about fire, you know, there's a mm-hmm. sense of the person with the fire has more power, perhaps, than the person without fire, right? Mm-hmm. But in the way that the technology that help us with communication, and especially social media, and we just have so much access to so much information all the time. Information like we have no right to have mm-hmm. in some ways. Like, I shouldn't know all the things about that person that I know, mm-hmm. right? Anyway, it's just a comment, but like, for me, that's something that I've just connected back to that at the very beginning.
Right, yeah.
The creation narrative of that desire to be God, and it gives us the illusion, mm-hmm. however briefly or not, that we are close to that.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, the ability to exercise power and control.
Yeah. Yeah. And to be omniscient.
Helpful. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of the language you hear about this kind of stuff really sounds very religious in that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Ray Kurzweil says in a film I watched about his life, that we should be becoming gods by transcending our biology. These limitations God's given us, well, that we've been given, that hold us back, we should be able to transcend those things through technology.
And I think that another thing I thought was when you were talking about, like, what does it mean to be human? And part of what it means to be human is to be finite. Mm-hmm. I mean, we are physically bound mm-hmm. in time and space and in our bodies. So I can't be two places.
That's right, yeah.
But it's this idea that we can transcend that somehow. Mm-hmm. But even mm-hmm. by attempting to transcend that, mm-hmm. even by being next to Nikki at the dinner table but texting on my phone, like trying to mm-hmm. be in two relationships at once or two places at once, we're dehumanizing mm-hmm. ourselves, because part of the limitation of boundedness is part of what means.
Right, right. Sarah Stone was showing me an ad for the Oculus Rift that was saying that it makes it possible to do what can't be done, or we can do what can't be done.
Yeah.
And yeah, we tend to always see limitation as a bad thing,
right.
and not ever as a gift. But it's actually part of our createdness. And I think we also see a huge affirmation of that in the incarnation, that God would limit himself to a human body is huge. So we can't look at that as somehow a failure of God to be God.
Right.
It's his glory to do that.
Yeah.
Other thoughts? Yes.
I want to go back to your airport story where you were frustrated and disappointed as you stared around the airport at the barriers to relationships everyone was putting up. So I think these four points are very good for how we approach technology ourselves and how we approach it within the communities where we have influence in our families. But how do these four things help us with that disappointment as we try to engage the world and the people around us who are totally submerged and absorbed? And I mean, I had a similar situation on an airplane where it was a flight to Hong Kong, 12 hours, and I had great conversations with people sitting next to me for about 15 minutes of those 12 hours, and then it becomes protocol for everyone to tune out for the next 11 hours and 15 minutes before the descent happens.
Mm-hmm.
Then everyone unplugs and has a nice little chit-chat about the weather and where they're going for about another 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do we... It just seems like it's a wall that's not going to go away when it comes to the overall world. What do you think?
Yeah, that's a really great question, and it's one I haven't totally Well, I definitely haven't figured out the answer to it. But,
can I think?
Yeah.
Off of your thinking? Mm-hmm. sorry. I don't know. As you're talking, part of me is thinking about, one of the main reasons that we don't have real relationships is because real relationships take time. Mm. And I wonder if we live on airplanes, to follow your story.
I had time. I had 12 hours.
You had 12 hours. Yeah. But
I was willing to spend it talking.
But I'm an introvert. I'm an introvert, and I can't do it in 12 hours. I need 12 dates. I'm kidding. We do know each other a little bit, but some of the reason that I don't chat it up with somebody on an airplane is because my trust is valuable, and I need to know that when I'm sharing my real life with someone, I need to know where I'm dropping that arrow, so to speak. And so part of me wonders if part of what we see in airports is some of the problem of it's a truncated timetable. And it's inherently transient. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so we sort of know, okay, barrier's up, and I'm only going to be here for a minute, so I'm not going to give anything of myself because, you know what I'm saying? I don't know. Yeah.
I think that definitely makes a lot of sense and is true. My grandma loves to be on airplanes or anywhere because she loves to evangelize to anyone that she meets. And I'm not that person. But I think it can be the beginning of something. These moments can be the beginning of something. Not everybody wants to share everything, but it could be a first conversation, or it doesn't have to be pouring. It's not the verbal vomit. That's the thing. It's the beginning of something. Sarah Chestnut talks about laying cards down and seeing what card another person lays down, and you do it bit by bit. But relationships start somewhere. Even for introverts, you have a first moment where you meet someone. And yeah, it's too bad about the airplanes because that was the kind of the last protected space when we didn't have Wi-Fi on them.
Yeah.
But that's been taken away. Sarah Chestnut.
I was just thinking, I don't think the problem is necessarily. I think that the airplane thing is indicative of where it is everywhere else. I don't want to pretend that I'm going to have a lifelong friendship with anybody that I sit next to on the plane. That would be a really rare and surprising occurrence. That could easily happen, but to expect that is probably more indicative of our deep, deep hunger for real connection. And the fact that what we see in airports or what we see in airplanes is just what we see in our homes. It's what we see in our intimate spaces. That seems like that's a bigger problem.
Right.
There's not a difference.
Yeah.
And it's hard. It's harder. It's harder to make a change in your home too, in some ways. Mm-hmm. Let's start there. if that is actually the place where we have some control and dominion, how do we make a change there? Right. No, I can't make a change with all the airports in the world,
I think that's helpful, and I think you can only do what you can to change. You may be a person who designs airports, and then you could make a difference in that way. But you can only start where you can, and I think a lot of this is we have to show something that looks better than what's being offered by the religion of technology. So we have to provide something in our families and our communities that looks like it's life-giving in a different way. So. Yeah, in whatever way we can do it. I think that this is going to continue to be a problem for sure. I don't see a way to rewind that, and neither do I want to. I don't want to go back to very simple technology. Times.
Was next summer to the airplane, they don't really have to be talking for 12 stars, solid hours. But also, there can be a certain amount of conversation and friendliness and everything without actually giving up revealing something of yourself you might want to. There's all sorts of things you could talk to them about.
The
patriots, for instance. Just one example, you talk about 100 things. You're not really giving up something, but to be friendly and to have conversation.
Yeah, just to know that you're surrounded by people and not just their phones and screens. I think there's something to be said for very small
things. You can say something interesting too.
Yeah, they may.
Without really giving away yourself.
Right. Sure. Andrew.
I really appreciate Dr. Jefferson. I'm trying to apply this to my interaction with my brother, who's grown up in that was the dawn of his social middle school years, and I've just watched as that's really affected his interaction, and it seems like there's been this shift in, I want to say, currency for social exchanges, to where in his generation, sorry, I don't want to make it sound like us versus them, but my little brother, who's just 4 years younger than me, seems to have just a very, very different prerogative, or his underlying reasons for interaction with people revolve around social media. And I find it interesting how technology has seemingly helped us buy into it and made us its tools. I don't get how, I guess it's marketing, the advertisement that happens on social media, and that's, but it's like this vicious thing. And so I guess I'm thinking about how do you convey this to someone who's not interested, because I assume that the majority of us here, if not everyone, is kind of on this healthy natural currency of exchange and feeling valued as an act. But my brother, there isn't that narcissistic main status. And people seeing you're one up. Then he doesn't want to do it.
Right. What was that you said to me about the 4th of July, his experience of the 4th of July, that he had to have a story?
Yeah.
If he didn't do something with his friends, he wouldn't have a story for the 4th of July, and he needed to have a story he could put on Instagram, Facebook?
I don't know.
Snapchat, sorry. You're often living your life through other people's eyes to what they'll see when they look at your updates. And that was one of the reasons I went off Facebook, because I felt like I was not doing things just to do them. I was doing them because of what other people would think of me doing them. And that seemed a very unhealthy way to live. It's hard. Of course, it's hard to challenge people for misuse of technology, what you see as misuse. And not everyone will take well to it. If you have a trusting relationship, they may.
Yeah.
It's worth trying, but they may not.
Say, I can't be his dad.
And I think there's times and places, but I think, especially if your kids are younger or whatever, then that's the time where you can start instituting those things, as a family, to have policies around what happens at the dinner table. It just becomes harder when people are older. But I think, if you have a group of friends, or if you have a friend where it's really bothering you, I think it's possible to say something.
Yeah.
And, in a positive way, too. I want to be with you. I want to spend time with you. I want to hear who you are.
I explicitly said on my New Year's invites last year that you weren't allowed to have your phones.
Good.
Until after midnight.
Yeah.
Some people were offended. They're like, was it about me? Why do you care? This is a trend that I'm trying to debunk.
Yeah, it can be simple things. Ben.
I was wondering whether part of our feeling of being paralyzed when we're in a public place and everybody's on their phone and everything is just being too cautious about seeming to be obnoxious.
Right, totally.
Just starting conversations with somebody.
Yeah.
And we so don't want to offend. Mm-hmm. We so don't want to make someone else feel uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
But they really want to be looking at their phone. How dare I? Mm-hmm. Interrupt that. Well, who cares?
Yeah.
And I think on some level, my experience is very shaped by life here, obviously, but I find sometimes when students arrive, there's a bit of a shock when it comes to the limitation on technology, and there's maybe a painful day or two, and then a actual sense of great relief and freedom. And I like what you said about trying to articulate positive reasons, because every person we look at who's looking at their phone actually wants to be free. They actually desire, like, they actually desire the very things that they're cutting themselves off from. And it doesn't, it may not be, it may be just below the surface. It's not necessarily something that requires massive brainwashing and reconditioning. Someone may find a conversation with a stranger to be a really refreshing thing. Something they were missing without knowing, or something. I don't know. I think if there's some hope for the airport where everyone's just staring at their phone. We just have to be. Not that I'm good at this, because I'm a total hypocrite here, but like, we have to be willing to seem obnoxious. To be that person that's like, oh, do I really have to talk to this person? I want to zone out.
You're good at that, Ben. Don't worry.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point. And I think, yeah, like me at the poetry reading, like, I wanted to talk to somebody, but I was too nervous to make the step to do it. And I found that if you do talk to somebody, whether it can be like the smallest thing to begin talking with someone, but there can be interesting conversations. I have had interesting conversations in airports, like with that one guy. I think it takes that risk to be the first one to look dumb.
So, Ben, what percentage of people in New England do you think would be delighted that you interrupt their phone? And what percentage are going to require brainwashing?
Probably no one would be delighted at first. That's the whole point, is to be willing to be, like, I don't know. I feel like when you were talking, I feel like part of what makes me reluctant to interrupt somebody when they're engaging with the phone is that you feel like you're stepping into some intimate moment that they're having, or interrupting a really important connection they're having with whoever. Maybe it's not an important connection at all, but that's how they're treating it. And so to convince myself that actually I have a privilege of being a real person in the same room with this person, I have a right. Like, interrupt you.
Yeah.
Because I'm right here.
Yeah.
I don't know whether that's true or not.
That's very interesting. Yeah.
But like, I'm sitting next to you. Why shouldn't I talk to you?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. That's really interesting. Maybe that's a human right. Whatever. The right of presence. Marty, you've had your hand up.
No, I totally agree. I mean, I've been sort of thinking along the same line. I've had over the years, I think, quite significant conversations with people in airports. Maybe earlier more than before the tech revolution, but one doesn't have to sort of barge in. One can say, could I ask you a question? Can I ask you something? You know, and that's a way if somebody is actually right, on their phone. But also, I always look around for anyone I can make eye contact with, because there are other people you can make eye contact with. There are a lot of people you can't. But look around, and there usually are some people you can make eye contact with and smile. And often, they smile back. And I think part of it, too, is to... Your grandmother loves to sit on airplanes so she can evangelize people. I guess I would see it... I sort of see it, and when I travel, sort of just pray, aware of God's providence, okay? Mm-hmm. I make my plans, but God directs my steps. I don't know anything about this person, but then maybe, we may have even a 5-minute conversation may actually be significant. I may never know until Christ comes back. I mean, I never know. And some conversations, end up being really like that. There's an amazing story of the guy that started Arosha, the Christian Environmental Bird Watching Organization, and he was on a plane. He was on a plane, got in a conversation with the guy next to him. I don't remember the details. But they talked, and at the end, and he told the story of Arosha and the need for property and everything. And
he was treating the stewardess really bad.
That's right.
He interrupted. Rebuked the guy.
That's right.
Because he was treating the stewardess so bad. Risking everything in the way of propriety and politeness. Right. Somebody thought, what am I doing here? This guy who was dissing the stewardess. And the guy, that then had a really interesting conversation.
This is a really important story. But, telling him off for being so rude to the stewardess, had a long conversation at the end. the guy sitting next to him wrote a check for something like $1 million for his organization. So he gave it to him.
Yeah.
Talk about God's unexpected.
Don't expect that to happen.
Yeah.
Expecting God's providence, he didn't very short, just treat people as human beings. He's saying, okay, I'm a human being, these people are human beings, they may not know what that means.
Right.
But looking for eye contact, and I bet you anything, this is one area where ageism is a big factor, because older people just aren't so tech savvy. Mm-hmm. I speak of myself. They're not as tech savvy as younger people, and so you might find you have eye contact with some older people if you can smile and have a conversation.
Sounds great. Yeah, my grandma has amazing stories from the plane, incidentally. that's a great point. Kat.
I was just going to say, like, I think that we can look at this as just, like, because it is, to me, it is really sad, because I work in Boston, and I take the Red Line T every day, and it's just super sad, because even when the train is outside, and we're looking up at Charles River, and I'm like, oh, like, people are just, like, on their phones, and I'm like, really? Like, Facebook is cooler than this river that has, like, the sun shining? But so, like, and it's just sad. Yeah, and it's just the attitude that everybody shares, and it's just, you are weird. But that's the thing, is, like, what are we called to be as Christians? Are we called to, like, just immerse ourselves in the culture, or are we called to be shine like stars? Like, and so I almost feel like we can see this as an opportunity, because we've identified that this is a problem and that there is a need for something more, but we have the solution. And so I guess, like, rather than feeling kind of hopeless, we can feel super hopeful that it's like, wow, because the culture is so this way, we're going to stand out even more, mm-hmm. just, like, as Christ followers, because we're going to be so different, and, like, we're going to be, you know, certain, because we have the answer, and we're not going to be just kind of, you know, oh, like, I guess this is the best there is. It's like, no, we know this isn't the best there is. Like, we know that there is, like, that relationship with God that it just will satisfy your deep longing, so...
Right.
Right. I don't know.
Yeah.
Just kind of interesting about that.
No, I think that's really important to be able to present a different way of being. But it's not easy. It's not easy to get people to buy into that, for sure. But I think that's the only way to do it. Rather than just saying, no, 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 this is horrible.
Yeah.
And being fearful, people don't listen to that. They have to be shown something different, I think. Something that's good. And be able to look at the river again. Yeah. Danny. Yeah, you.
My name is Dan. growing up with what you were saying, that I felt really big wanting to be sort of obnoxious. I've, just in my own life, kind of related with you up there being introverted and not taking 12 days or whatever. I struggle, but I try to, like, push through awkwardness. I think we need to, like, be okay with being awkward within ourselves, at least within myself. But also, just in relationship with the people you're talking to, it's not something that, like, will immediately I won't wake up one day and I'll be like, perfectly fine, I'm talking to strangers, you know, like, I think it will take practice, mm-hmm. just to say, I'm okay with the boring bits, you know, and mm-hmm. the parts where I fumble over my words and I can't count my change for the cashier because I'm trying to think of something interesting to say, you know,
yeah.
like, I think it's just, it just will take time to become comfortable and mm-hmm. being awkward and meeting someone where you are and where they are, and,
yeah,
and being willing to be interrupted ourselves, just like mm-hmm. we're interrupting other people's lives. One of the reasons I tend to not like to go like to grocery stores or whatever, like when it's really busy, because you have to do this like weird, like interrupting cart dance, you know? Like, you know what I mean? And like just to like practice those things and be like willing to be awkward.
Right.
I don't know.
The willingness to be awkward is a social skill in and of itself. It's good. I like it. Emma.
One thing I noticed when traveling with public transport in the U.S. and from the Netherlands was that a lot of people, I actually had a lot of conversations with people, but they seemed to kind of vomit their whole life story all over me. And I don't know, I was okay with it, but I don't think that's the way you should have a conversation. But I was wondering if you think that has to do with technology, like because we live in an age where technology happens and we don't really know how to have those conversations in an appropriate way.
Yeah.
Or did I just hit the jackpot? I don't know, because in Holland people don't really make small talk. Like, what do you want? And in America, I don't know, I just noticed here. People actually talk to you. I kind of like that, but I also am very suspicious of it. Maybe it's Amtrak, I don't know.
Well, I think,
I do notice that, like, I don't want to say Americans, but I'm half American. I do kind of, notice that, like, that oversharing in this first conversation we're having with someone. Mm-hmm. So how do you think the card thing makes sense? But do you think that has to do with technology and that we don't really know how to have a face-to-face conversation?
I think you're, like, it may be partly cultural. Americans are friendlier than Canadians in some ways too, even in New England. But I think part of it is that we've lost the skills to read other people, partly, like, what Sherry Turkle calls the empathic skills, like eye contact and reading people's body language and listening well to someone else. So often we're not really assessing, like, what effect our words are having on people, so we just keep going. So that could be part of it. I don't know who all the people were that you talked at you. But I think, we're used to having interactions that are about us. And so it becomes harder to be present to someone else and listen to who they are. So maybe that's it. Yeah.
I would, you mentioned, like, biking, and I realize, like, that's so uncommon in America. Like, I mean, yeah, people do it in city centers and whatnot, but that's so new to me to hear about Peter biking to and from the pub. And we cater to ourselves, like, you know, our own car with our own air conditioning. You can go, you know, from your house to your job and back in an air conditioned space the whole time. I do want to say that you talked about the tea reminding me an ad that I saw that Ray Ban made, and all it said was be authentic, but there are two people in the middle of the train amongst others who had just cell phones like in front of their eyes, and they're kind of just like, you can't even tell where they're looking, just kind of controlled, and then there are these two people, of course, with Ray Bans, and they're looking at each other, and it's like, you know, a guy and a girl, they're attractive, whatever, but still, it's like, even commercial America realizes the epidemic, I guess, of what technology is doing to us, and some try to, you know, leverage that.
To self.
To sell well, more, but...
Yeah. And I think that's part of the problem. It's like, people are recognizing these things, but they still want to have their cake and eat it too. Like, if you look at the kind of hipster things that are, like I mentioned, like the slow food movement and all of these things, it's like, a lot of these things are so good, but at the same time, people always want to have the newest iPhone at the same time as they do these things.
Yeah.
And they want Instagram pictures of everything they're doing. So I don't think people are willing yet to make the most people are not willing to make the sacrifices it requires to go without, because they're not convinced of the good of giving up something. Like, they'll take more things, new things that that seem like more DIY or whatever, but they won't give up things that will cost them something. But it's hard to persuade people to sacrifice. Michaela.
It's interesting that Andy Crouch talks about the difference between technology and device in the TechWise family. And he said that device has taken away wisdom, skill, and courage. And it's interesting, just in light of conversations at their clinics, just to notice where courage, skill, and wisdom has now been taken away in conversations. And so those three prongs and he's been called it devices has created easy everywhere now, so we've lost the ability to take meaningful risks, to have courage, to even have skill to have conversation, and the wisdom to even know our place in, you know, that whole idea of, like, even body language or empathetic. And just the, even the word device, what that means now, and you know, to hear my own child say, well, I want a device. Like, oh, Lord. All the devices. We all have devices. But that is now a real thing. An object more than just, like, our simple devices.
Right. Interesting. Yeah.
And then just my second point is the idea of that you want a story for the 4th of July, the idea of a story. Mm-hmm. I heard an interview with Eugene Peterson where he talks that we are all story people, where we all have a beginning, middle, and an end. And that is a gift that God has given us, is a story. But we have lost the ability to live that story, because we want a different one. And just the idea of the three prongs of courage, wisdom, and skill, and the courage to live your own story well. And what social media has done is to tell you that your story doesn't
right.
That God's gift is a story, like,
right.
And a bigger story.
Right.
The ultimate big right. story.
Yeah, we're always editing our story to make it more acceptable to people around us, or trying to live someone else's story, comparing on Pinterest or whatever. So, yeah, but I really like those three points: wisdom, skill, and courage in conversation. It's very good. Yeah, Danny.
Just going back to what everyone said about how conversation and technology, how to interact with, you know, what that leads to. I was thinking about how through social media in particular, and such things, like we can share information without consequences most of the time, or without like really dire consequences. And in reality, like in good, but in actual relationships and conversations, like that's not true.
Right.
And so you can post something on Facebook, post something on Facebook, and you can get likes or dislikes or whatever. But it's not actually the consequences of that severe, but in reality you are actually influencing someone else, you know, in a conversation. So I think maybe through, I don't know, there might be a connection between the use of social media and sharing, not having consequence, and then that translating into real life where people can just feel like they can share whatever, and be okay with whatever happens after that.
right. Drop the mic.
Right,
that's the point to be true. Yeah, Marta?
Yeah, I just have two comments, to Ben's point and sorry, your point, just about myself and yours about good welcome meeting. I kind of think that people are just not used to being listened to, because I think they are losing the routine, the habit of actually having conversation. And I think that, you know, technology basically teaches us to put things out there about us. So that's the verbal or digital, whatever word that is out there, is I'm presenting my life to you, and that's really what conversation is. And I might read about yours, but really what matters is what I'm, you know, sharing about mine.
Right.
So in that regard, I think we are losing that sense of being actually actively listened to, that somebody can interrupt my, you know, sharing of life with a good question, you know, and actually post something or just say, okay, stop here for a moment, can you explain that? You know, can we actually get more, you know, deeper into this or the details or help me understand? So I think we are more used to that because of the digital world around us too, that, you know, we post whatever we want people to hear or see or whatever. So I think that contributes to people being more in this disposition. But also, to your point, Ben, and I think it relates, that I think what we should perhaps try to do is come up with good questions, because so many people, because they are more used to people talking at us and us talking and just saying things, as opposed to, you know, stopping them with a good question. So I think if we could be very creative about how to pose a question that's interesting or surprising or unexpected, that could draw people out of them being engaged with their devices and other conversations, that actually, you know, just being, yeah, just all of a sudden interested or, you know, just surprised by a good question that they, you know, never heard before, in a sense, you know?
Yeah.
Rather than doing small talk or better talk or, you know, whatever it can be, sort of a beginning of a conversation, just ask something that's sort of just, in a way, shocking, not in a negative sense, sort of surprising. Okay, I never thought about it. Then, you know, that leads to maybe a more interesting conversation.
Yeah. I like that point, and I think I actually... I do that, but I sometimes don't like small talk either, actually, lots of times. And so I kind of have a list of questions in my head that are, like, good discussion questions that are not super threatening.
Yeah.
And I use them at Libri or in other situations if I'm talking with someone and it's, like, something that a person can talk on for a while about themselves. And I find that very helpful if I'm just, like, not really sure what to ask or whatever. And so I think that's a, like, it's a, it takes practice for us to learn to even be interested in each other enough to hear the answer, because we're often, like, so consumed with what other people think about us, like you're saying, and that's all that's running in our heads. And, like, what impression am I creating? What are they thinking? And you're not really thinking about who the other person is or what they're experiencing. So, empathy.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be relational. The question doesn't have to pertain to the, you know, it doesn't have to be about the person's life.
Right.
It can be an idea, a thought,
anything,
you know, that we can both relate to.
Right, totally. Yeah. Mary Frances.
It actually tied me with what she was saying. He just walked out. But the question about the airplane, I think part of it is that, like, we're just not curious. Like, we're just not curious anymore, and there's that piece of, like, okay, so what do we do? What do we do in this culture where people sit next to each other for 12 hours and don't talk? I think a piece of it is asking questions, not just expecting to tell your story, but to ask questions about all kinds of things. But I think that's, you know, the technology in some ways has dampened our curiosity, because we don't, right, we can just Google the answer. Like,
right.
We don't care for it. I mean, and so I think thinking about what role curiosity plays in our own lives, and how are we or are we not curious about the world around us and the people sitting next to us, and I think, like, that virtue of curiosity. And then I just wanted to tell a quick story. It was kind of what Ben was talking about, like the opposite. So a couple of months ago, Dick, Ben, Michaela, and I, and Ben and his kids, went to Europe for a Libri meeting, and we were all on the Logan Express bus going to the airport. So we got on the bus in Framingham. So there were seven of us, and we were sitting in this collective, you know, 2, 2, 2, 1, whatever. And we were sort of having a conversation, all four of us. I didn't think we were that well.
No.
but we were having a conversation on the bus. You know, it was like a 30-minute bus ride, whatever. And there was a woman sitting in front of Michaela with her phone out, with headphones on her phone. And she turned around and, like, really chastised us. I mean, Nikki got it, because she was like, because we were being so loud, she couldn't hear even through her headphones. And I was sitting.
You can't hear headphones. I still hear it.
And the funny thing is that I was sitting where I actually could see the screen of her phone, and she was just thumbing through Facebook. I mean, it was like, maybe a minute before she'd been watching a video or a work module or something. I have no idea. But it was an interesting, like, I just thought, like, how rare it is on a bus, on the TV, on a train, in the airport, do I see, like, a group of people with their phones put away having a really active conversation.
Right.
And that's what we were doing. And she was so annoyed.
What did you say? How did you respond?
She just said, okay.
Yeah.
She's like, okay, sorry. I mean, yeah. But, I mean, she's like, could you please keep it down? You're so loud. I can read through my noise canceling.
Heaven forbid.
And of course, you know. Yeah. But anyway, it's just, you know, it's like, oh, how this thing is a term. Like that, not that long ago, that would have been the norm, to have a family or group of people who are traveling together, having a conversation together as they travel. And we were, you know, chastised for that because she couldn't hear whatever she was watching on her. It's not like she couldn't hear the person next to her talking to her. She couldn't hear through her.
And that relates to what Ben was saying.
Yeah.
And like, do I have a right, because I'm a person, to be present with, who's actually here to be present with you?
Yeah.
Or is the primary right to protect your individual
world
with your phone? What is the right relationship that's taking precedence? It seems like the relationship with our phone is being protected over the
seven of us.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So it's showing a shift in cultural value for sure. Sarah.
Talking a lot about the social impact of this. I was curious, so I want to kind of step back from that and just ask, in the reading you've done, have you come across anything about, like, just the level of fatigue that we live with? I'm just thinking, actually, to try and be more creative in my questions, to try and, like, have, like, I just feel really exhausted even thinking about that. And so it makes me aware of, like, gosh, the level of fatigue that I live with, and I think I have pretty moderate screen views in a day.
Yeah.
And, you know, just the shift from, you know, being a society that went to bed when the sun went down and got up when the sun went down, and now being, like, electric all the time, and now screens, you know, I've read one of the main things, if you have sleep disorders, give yourself at least a half an hour screen-free before bedtime. Like, yeah, I don't know. Thoughts on that? Or have you come across stuff on just sleep deprivation and fatigue? And it's so basic. Like, it's just such a basic thing. Like, we can't function socially if we're so strung out on lack of sleep.
Right. You also have a toddler.
But I mean, she sleeps. She sleeps. You know. But do I? You know, I mean, I think, like I said, I think I have relatively moderate use screen use, you know, but I'm thinking on a cultural level, I think we're sort of walking zombies.
Totally.
No wonder we can't have conversations with each other.
You're never off. It's a state of hypervigilance. That's the thing. And you're always expecting the latest thing, and you're never able to focus on a thing. And that is wearing. It's like the fight or flight response all the time.
Yeah.
And I think this was a video Nikayla sent me, an interview with a guy. I don't remember his name, but just saying don't use your phone as an alarm. you don't need to do that. You don't need to have it in your room. When you kind of sleep, there needs to be time where you know it's not going to be there. And that's been it for me too. It's like, I have a smartphone, I do use it, but I need times where I know that I'm not going to have it. So for me, one of those times is when I eat meals, and that's not just my phone, but my computer. I try not to use technology when I'm eating a meal, even if I'm eating alone, and then I read instead. And it might just be like 15 minutes that I scarf down a meal by myself. But that's like one time in the day that I know that I've protected. To be present and to be thankful for my food and to read something. So I think like we need this kind of sacred spaces or whatever that are protected. But it's hard, I think, because it goes back to that junk food kind of idea. Like, if you're tired at the end of the day, like you do just want to go on Facebook or you do just, you know, want to put on Netflix or whatever. And it takes the effort to do something that feels unnatural, which will be more satisfying long term. But yeah, that's hard to do. And of course, like, now we're required to keep up with a world that's sped up and keep doing what's expected. So it makes, like we'll miss out on certain things, I guess, if we make choices that are different. Like when I chose to go off Facebook, I realized I wasn't going to be invited to as many things anymore. I wouldn't see people's photos, all these things, but that to me was the detriments of Facebook for me personally outweighed that. Like, and
so your question up here about like this type of sacrifice,
right, mm-hmm. right, sort of, right. So you have to see the toll it's taking on you, and sometimes it takes trying it to find out.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's you don't really know until you try something. Don't try everything, kids. But I think if you look at yourself and you see that some of that exhaustion is due to the way that you use technology, like you have to make a hard call sometimes, that will cost something.
I was just thinking about how interesting it is that like how smartphones are, and just like how even like for me, like carving out time, like I have a lunch, like during my lunch break I just bring a book, because I work in VR, I'm always like on my computer, and like it's exhausting. It is, like, it's like really tiring. And so like I just like will bring a book and sit outside, and it's just weird how like people will engage with me so much more and just be like, what are you reading? What is that? And it's like,
right.
Yeah, and it's like interesting. It's almost like even though you're reading a book, like it's more inviting than that screen, which is so weird. Because you're almost like, I'm almost like, okay, I'm reading, but like, oh, that's cool, you know. Like, people feel like, oh, but she's not, you know, so like plugged in.
Right.
So
right.
It's like, I can still engage with her. Interesting.
It's interesting how different a book can be from a phone. Like, it's still a thing you're looking at, but
it
invites something. People can at least see that you're holding a book. We don't know what you're really doing when you're on your phone. So it's like,
what if we treated people's phones like books? Like, oh, what are you looking at?
Yeah. I have a phone too.
I think also, like, when people look at phones, like, something changes in the way that their eyes look. Like, they look like they're not paying attention. Or sometimes they look, like, really sad or really just, like, flat. And you're like, what just happened to you? Like, where did you go into your phone? Or if you're reading a book or if you're, like, literally just sitting there smiling at people. They look more alive. Right. And, like, people can tell, like, oh, their eyes are not drawn to something that's blue and shiny and attracting them. And, I don't know, I take care of a little four-year-old and, like, literally show them to the park and be like, hi, my name is Sophie. Do you want to play with me and be my friend? And it's like, can't ever be like a four-year-old and talk to people and make friends and not be afraid to, you know. But it's hard because we're not four. And, yeah. Other people aren't either, so yeah. But I noticed that, like, when people finally look up from their screen, like, their eyes sort of wake up, and they're like, oh, hello world.
Yeah.
And then you can start talking to them. Mm-hmm. So, like, breaking them off of looking at the screen just by a simple comment, or like, oh, isn't the sky beautiful today? And I'm like, sky?
Yeah.
It sort of wakes them up, so I don't know.
Right, I think that's a good point. The sad thing is a lot of kids are getting they're not getting a response from their parents, like, yeah. If they don't have eye contact, which is so important for child development, because parents come to pick them up and they're on their phone and they don't look up when their child comes down the stairs.
Give them something.
Well, I was talking to a girl who works in Brooklyn earlier this term, and she said, yeah, kids are very young given an iPad, and that's what they learn to interact with. And she was actually talking about Lily, the chestnut's daughter, who's two, and she's just talking up a storm, starting to talk up a storm, and she said, these kids don't have that vocabulary because they are not being talked to, which is so sad. So it's very important. But Elizabeth, if you have a
question. So I was just, it's really ironic that I have to say this, but right before coming here, I was listening to a podcast.
It's okay.
So I was using my
text
on it. But on the podcast, there made this point that I just keep thinking of it as we're talking. This anthropologist had done studies and said that at first, mankind, humans, create things in society, create society, and then what they've created turns around in a short period of time and begins to create them.
Hmm.
And if you think about that, just even cars, how much that's changed our society from before we had cars. Mm-hmm. When you think about, you know, the Industrial Revolution, how that changed things, you know. Even fiber, how that changed things, electricity, but technology, same thing. Because so much of what's being said here is just within even like the last 20 years, how we've seen technology churning around and kind of creating us, even creating children that can't, they don't have as big a vocabulary.
Right.
It's having a huge impact on who we are.
And I think that goes back to what Michaela was saying, just that we start out by thinking that we can become, who was talking about being gods? Whoever was saying that.
Mary Frances.
Mary Frances was saying that, right. About like, we think that we can control the technology, we can be the masters, Kevin Kelly says, and we end up the slaves.
Yeah.
And I think that often when we start out with the technology, it seems optional. Like, it always seems optional, and it's like, well, you could take it or leave it. But then later it isn't, because that's how society functions. It functions around that. So even if you don't really want it, you feel like you have to keep up with everyone else. So, unfortunately, it's very hard to make those calls. And, I mean, but technology is progressive in some ways, like, or it is definitely progressive, because that's part of human innovation, but we have to be able to choose why we're making the choices we are about what technologies we make. I mean, that's helpful. Ben?
Well, something I think about is, there are different ways to use technology. Probably any technology can have different uses. With fire, you could use it to cook food, or you could use it to burn someone's house. With phones, you could use them to open the world's biggest, best, most likable book, Facebook. Or you could listen to lectures, or start started a digital photography club, and someone who did that. So there may be ways we can find to use the technology better.
Right. Yeah, and that's something I didn't say that much about in my lecture, and I'm grateful for those examples because that was something I was hoping that maybe we could talk about a bit, is just what are positive uses for the technology that we have that can actually foster relationship and solitude and these things. And I would love to hear more than that. If people want to leave, you're free to leave. I just want to say that because it's fun too. So if you want to leave or if you want to stay, we can keep talking. Melissa.
Yeah, it's funny, everyone's giving plain illustrations, but what often strikes me too is often I fly and there's a lot of turbulence, and when it gets really scary, like people suddenly, I think they're maybe reminded of their humanness, and they will sort of, like, that sparks a conversation, like whenever the plane dives or, you know, things like that. And so I think it's like a reaching out for comfort, and your phone isn't going to provide that in those moments. Where you want to receive that human connection. So just that innate need for comfort
can very interesting.
Really be had with a person, even a stranger,
right.
Providing it, I think, and how often we need comfort. But I was also curious about just sharing, because, you know, I think you said earlier, I mean, that's an innate need, too. We want to share, we want people to see our lives. And so if you're not posting it, if you're not posting a picture of your trip or something like that, like, just ways to share. And, you know, when I came back from Liberty last term, I think I agree, like, people don't ask good questions. Like, people aren't or willing to sit and be present for a longer answer. And so it just seems like there's not that setting to really share or to gather or to, I don't know, because I think to be able to tell your story or to show your pictures is really good thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it used to be that people would get all their slides and they make you sit and watch them for like hours. But yeah, we don't do that. But I think there are ways to do that. And yeah, we just have to be creative about how to do that. And part of the thing is I think that when you put everything on Facebook or Instagram, then you have nothing left to share when you come to someone. Like, I found going off of Facebook, and I'm not saying everyone should go off Facebook, but I would hear news from people, and I really loved that experience. Like, if someone was engaged, I would hear it either from them or from someone else. And then I would share a moment with that person about the excitement of this, rather than being like, oh, like. and that's become really special to me. And you know, like, one of the things I've been doing this term is keeping a sketch journal. So that's a way of me sharing my experiences here, because I don't have Facebook or Instagram, that I can only share it with a person who's actually present with me, so it limits my circle. But to me, it's a very rich way of sharing. Not everybody likes doing art, but there could be other ways, you know, just printing out some photos and making, like, a physical photo album or people's scrapbook or whatever. Or one thing we do sometimes at Canadian Libri is just have a night where we sit and tell stories about our lives. and that's always a really cool experience to actually hear. You know, we'll give a theme or whatever, but they'll spur other stories on, and it's kind of wonderful to just hear everybody listens to one person tell the story about their lives. So I don't know if you have other thoughts or things that you've observed or that you think might be helpful, or anyone else who has a suggestion.
One thing I like to do is ask someone to show me some of their favorite pictures they've taken. They usually always have their phone in their pocket, and to share together there, instead of, like you said, in my room alone looking at their life on Facebook, but to do it with him. Or, like, have you written any, like, have you made a good note lately on your phone, or whatever you read, like, if someone reads a lot, I don't know, trying to incorporate what you know they're doing with your phone,
right.
and asking them about that,
right.
And it's been helpful, especially with my dad, who is on all the time, and to ask him
about that instead of just mm-hmm. ignoring the phone and trying to call into something else, which yes, to do that, but also the phone's not going to go away, and to how to call people, how we can do it together in some way. And there's like games also, like headbands that we do as a family with our phones, that we're using phones, but we're doing it together, and we're laughing, and we're doing a game together. Yeah, and I think that's helpful. Yeah, I have another idea.
Like playing catch with the phones.
Yeah. Thank you.
That's the first thing I
want to hear. Old school, old school.
It's becoming more and more alienating for people who aren't really, I mean, just going out, like, for example, a parking meter. We got a ticket at lunch yesterday because we put quarters in a parking meter in Wellesley, and the thing didn't seem to be working, but you're meant to have an app on your phone.
Yeah.
Well, Dick doesn't even have a smartphone. You have an app on your phone to pay for parking.
Right.
And you just say, I just want to scream at that kind of thing. I wish there was a person there, but there's mm-hmm. not a person, but at least mm-hmm. you used to take quarters and not give me a ticket.
Yep.
It took our quarters, but it didn't register them. And then we got a ticket. And this lady said, I just use my app.
Yeah.
But I mean, that must be, I'm talking about the only ones that feel alienated by that. Yeah. There have got to be,
I do too.
The older generation.
Yeah.
But just that it becomes more and more alienating for a lot of folks. Just have to have a smartphone.
Sure.
Or you don't have a smartphone.
When's the last time you call a payphone, for that matter, what do you do if you don't have a phone? And so, it starts out optional, and then it's no longer optional.
That's right.
If you want to, unless you make drastic, drastic choices to, live off the grid or whatever, then it's not really an option anymore. And so that can feel very frustrating for all of us, I think, sometimes. So, yeah.
I really appreciated, actually, what you were saying, too, because I think it shows a very gracious kind of attitude of being willing to meet people just where they are as well as where you would like them to be. And of course, we all have a sort of utopia picture in our mind of where we would all just be strolling in the Labrie Woods and having beautiful conversations all day long. This is my ideal absolute. But if I can be fully present, tangibly with that person, finding ways to incorporate their current experience and showing them to, beyond that, I think is a very gracious way to interact with people. And I personally, really appreciate Facebook Messenger because it helps me keep more regularly in contact with people who I am distant from, but I still want to follow their lives, but follow their minds more than just their activity. So, I take Facebook feed to give me, context clues of what I should ask them about in Messenger, and then I just, go to Messenger and, type them a whole letter because I know they'll actually read it and respond, versus an email where they might read it but might not respond, or a hand letter, which they might not do either. So, that's something that I find very useful to, employ all those good questions and, meet people where they're present.
Right, and that's a thoughtful, it requires thoughtfulness and reflection, and there are good ways to use this technology. I think you have to know your own limits, I guess, if you can be responsible using those things and if you can use them for good and not for evil. But yeah, there's definitely ways you can think about it to engage, for sure. Yeah. Well, I think let's end there. Thanks all for coming.